Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are here with Frans de Waal, and what you hear are both chimpanzees and bonobos. Well, you have 2,000 primates out here that run the full gamut from monkeys to, well, your...
apes. These guys are apes.
Yeah. And then you also have gorillas who live at the Atlanta Zoo, but
yeah.
They're not here.
No.
Are they very different from one to the next? You've got a full range of species.
Well, monkeys we usually consider quite different from apes. Apes are the group to which we belong.
You and I.
We don't usually consider ourselves apes, although some people probably do. But
well, it might be time to start thinking of ourselves that way.
The apes are orangutans, chimpanzees, gorillas, and bonobos, and us, basically. And the least known of that bunch is the bonobo. And that's partly because the bonobo was discovered very late, only in 1929. And because there are very few of them also in captivity.
Do they look a lot like chimps?
Yeah, they used to be confused with chimps until people started distinguishing them as a separate species. And then once you know the species, and especially if you study their behavior, it's sort of surprising that they were lumped together with chimpanzees.
How do you describe the difference between bonobos and chimps?
Well, physically, the difference is that the bonobo is much more elegant.
Elegant?
It's a more gracile species. It used to be called a pygmy chimp, but that's not really appropriate in the sense that they're not really small. They have long legs, and so they're more elegant in the sense that when they walk upright, for example, which they sometimes do, they walk almost more like an Australopithecus, and they have been compared with Australopithecus.
And that is Lucy, our ancestor,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So the bonobos look like Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And are they nice?
They're usually peaceful compared to chimps. Yeah, most of the time there is peace and sex in the bonobo
peace
society.
Peace and sex.
Yeah.
Well, you talk
not unrelated.
Well, in good natured, your wonderful book that talks about the rise or lack thereof of aggression in humans and what you've learned about that, as I understand it, from studying primates. You talk about the bonobos as a chance for us to think about other species near us as make love, not war.
Yeah, yeah.
And the chimps sort of the other way back. But most of us have this kind of naked ape idea that, well, we come from a ferocious long ago past, and, you know, we're going to whoop up on each other, and we're not a very nice social
species.
Well,
that's of course, there's sort of two major influences. One is, in the time of Darwin already, the struggle for life sort of metaphor gave us the idea that competition is what life is all about, and that's of course still the view of many people. Even though Darwin himself realized that a lot of species survive not by struggling with each other but by cooperating with each other. And for example, there are many social insects, there are many social mammals who survive basically through close cooperation and depend on groups for survival. And so they're not all fighting with each other, otherwise the groups would fall apart. And then the second major influence is after World War II, some people like Robert Ardrey and Conrad Lawrence and Desmond Morris started writing about aggression and how important aggression was. And I think it was partly an effort to explain what had happened in that period of time.
In World War II.
But at the same time, it was used by many people, including anthropologists, to reconstruct our past. We don't know much about our past, really. But to sort of explain that we became the dominant species in the world by conquering the world. And how did we conquer the world? By killing everyone else, including the Neanderthalers and so on. And hunting was an important part of that story also, which is a somewhat aggressive activity. And so there was a lot of emphasis on aggression, whereas there's so many elements in human behavior, such as morality and language and cooperation and technology, that deserve just as much attention as aggressiveness, I think.
Well, and you said the magic word, morality. I was struck with a book about animals, the book that you wrote, that deals substantially with morality and morality, the precursors, how humans developed this curious capability that is morality. And apparently we didn't just dream it up one day.
No, my idea, well, they're very noisy today.
Is this
which
aggression?
Is good for you, I suppose. No, they're not aggressive. Until now, we haven't seen any real serious aggression. They're just excited. I think they're waiting for food, and in addition, they're all hyped up about that female still.
Well, she is quite attractive.
for them, at least.
For them, at least, yes. Yeah. What about this business about morality? I think an awful lot of people say, well, that's one of the things that makes us human and animals. Animals is that we're moral and they're not.
Yeah, I'm not claiming that chimps are moral beings. I would be going a bit far in my mind. But I've looked at you know, this is like a 100-year-old debate about the evolution of morality, and I'm not sure we want to repeat that here. But basically what I've looked at is what kind of parallels to human moral tendencies can I find in chimpanzees or in other primates. And I find many parallels. The two main ones are the area of sympathy and empathy, like doing something for someone else or how you react to distressed individuals. And the other one is social norms and reciprocity rules, like if I do you a favor, do you have an obligation to me? And the word obligation is, of course, already a moral term that we use for that.
Mm-hmm.
And in those two areas, I see a lot of parallels. And so basically what I'm arguing in that book, Good Natured, is that the basic psychology that we have that makes it possible for us to be moral beings is present in chimpanzees. So let's say emotionally and intellectually they handle a lot of the same sort of issues. I'm not sure they're putting it all together in a moral system as mm-hmm. we do, with an autonomous conscience and with moral reasoning where we compare rules and say, if you accept this, you have also to accept that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not sure that chimps are doing that sort of things. But the basic psychology is there, and it's very similar.
I'm also hearing you say that this is a continuum and not a stop-and-go process.
Yeah, well, it's a bit like when you compare, let's say, 5-6-year-old children with adults. You're not going to draw a sharp line there. You're going to say, well, a lot of these tendencies that we as adults have, they're also present in the 6-year-old kids. And it's very hard to draw lines in development, and in the same way, it's very hard to draw lines in evolution.
That puts us back into the system of nature in a way, doesn't it? Rather than us being outside of these natural systems, doesn't that return humans into the...
Yeah, but there has always been a silly system anyway. It comes from René Descartes to some degree. It's older than him, but he made this sharp distinction, is that we have souls and animals don't have souls, and to draw a line. And drawing a line like that is very easy for a person in Europe who had never seen an ape, maybe, or maybe he had seen one ape in his life, yeah. I don't know. But people who are closer to the animal world, and especially animals like the non-human primates,
mm-hmm.
Don't usually draw these sharp lines, I think, because they have seen that that's not really possible.
Well, and part of this, I was just listening to you describe it, part of it is I would think, the language capability itself. If you take these tendencies that are present in the chimpanzees as an example, overlay language on that so you can start talking about these tendencies mm-hmm. and categorizing these tendencies, then it doesn't that get you to morality?
Well, yeah, that's a bit the attitude that Darwin himself took. Darwin was much smarter than his followers, I think.
And so, that's a common condition.
We're finding that.
And so Darwin didn't make, for example, you have now at the moment biologists who talk about selfish genes and all of that and depict the whole world as based on selfishness and competition. And Darwin himself had a much broader view. And he made this note one time that if you took a baboon or another primate and you looked at their affiliative and affectionate tendencies, you had basically the beginnings of a moral system, except for the reasoning capacities that we add to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we do put a big overlay over everything, culturally and linguistically and with our reasoning capacities. Our brain is 3 times bigger than a chimp brain, so there's something going on in our species that is not going on in
a lot of rationalization. Well, and
justification.
I ask that because in the work that we do as consultants, I frequently find that what passes for reason is really, in most cases, a rationalization for a decision that has already been made or for a course that I've already decided I want to pursue.
Yeah, I've done a lot of research on primate reconciliation. So what do primates do after a fight? And chimps, for example, will kiss and embrace after a fight. And as a result of that research, I always look at people. I look at people totally different, I think, than most people. And I see these reconciliations going on in the workplace or elsewhere, meetings, whatever. And I'm almost certain that most of the people don't even realize what they're doing at that moment. And if I, because I've done that a few times, I've walked up to people who I know very well and say, well, you know, I saw you reconciled with X, you know, because I knew they had had a fight and whatever. And they sort of looked baffled at me. And then after a few seconds, of course, they say, yeah, yeah, that's right, we did that. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't label it as such, and they do it basically unconsciously. They walk by someone, they tap him on the shoulder, or they make a nice remark, and for me that's the reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, it's a label, it's what you name it, it's the language.
But, yeah, but they've done it before they realize it.
Yeah.
Don't we give ourselves too much credit as being rational?
Oh yeah, we're not. Are we rational? I mean,
my evidence is diminishing hour by hour.
Well, and I, again, as I watch your companions down here who are as much like us as they are different, aren't they? These are the guys who are 98-99% the same DNA that we have.
Yeah, 98.5. Yeah.
98.5. Well, I was somewhere in the range.
Uh-huh.
Don't we have a great deal to learn from the other species?
What is really rational? Rational is a bit like a computer or something. I've always been surprised by the efforts to compare human intelligence with computers, because computers just run through 200 million options per second. That's what Deep Blue was doing.
Uh-huh.
That's what computers are very good at. But there's no emotion involved. And human rationality is always blended with emotion. There's no separation.
Hubert Dreyfus and a whole class of philosophers talk about the importance of context. And mm-hmm. that if you separate the reasoning from the contextual, and I think what the behaviors you're talking about are behaviors in context.
Yeah, yeah.
It is, you know, it's the relationship between and among the animals.
Well, and that it is action-based, that this isn't, the chimps aren't sitting around here thinking about stuff. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a very real continuity between what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're acting, and the context. Yes? Isn't this bigger than just thinking?
I have a question.
Uh-oh.
When we come back.
When we come back. I think that's an out cue. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is with me here. We're with Franz de Waal and an observation tower overlooking a whole community of chimpanzees at the Yerkes Primate Research Center. We're going to be right back. Stay with us.